And Radio Derb is on the air. This is your polychromatically genial host, John Derbyshire, with a selection from the week's news. Much to discuss this week, listeners, so let's go straight into it. Name of the week is undoubtedly Edward Snowden, the 29-year-old computer wizard who told a British newspaper that our Department of Defence tracks our phone records, emails, Google searches, etc. Depending on which outlet you're reading, Snowden is either a whistleblower or a traitor, either a hero or a villain. The Nation magazine, which is out on the far left, says Snowden has blown the lid off America's, quote, Stasi state. That's a reference to the old East German secret police, which, of course, the Nation had no objections to when East Germany was in business and the Stasi were pulling out dissidents' fingernails. On the other hand, some of the fiercer conservatives, like Ralph Peters, want to have Snowden boiled in oil. Peters says that Snowden has, quote, betrayed his country and, quote, subverted democracy and, quote, alerted our enemies about our most sophisticated capabilities. It's not just a simple left-right thing either. Conservatives, remember, favour small government, private liberty and the Constitution. The DOD keeping huge data banks of our personal communications is not exactly emblematic of small government. Privacy is obviously out the window, and the Constitution guarantees us against unreasonable searches and seizures. So plenty of conservatives, Theo Caldwell at the Daily Caller, for example, are willing to give Snowden a pass. Contrarywise, limousine liberal Senator Dianne Feinstein, who last time I noticed her was encouraging illegal alien homosexuals to get married after first surrendering their guns, has spoken of, quote, an avalanche of leaks that puts our nation's security in jeopardy, end quote. Where's the American public here? Well, Reuters did a poll. They found 46% of us with no opinion on the matter. The opinionated 54% broke 31-23 in Snowden's favour. So, which is it, hero or villain? Where does Radio Derb come down on this? We say the guy's a villain, although we'll add a lot of footnotes. I start with that newspaper that Snowden spilled the beans to, the London Guardian. I know that newspaper of old, from when I lived in England way back in the 70s and 80s. It's a cultural Marxist rag, way to the left, even of the New York Times. And it's played a not inconsiderable role in turning England into a multicultural police state. Basically, anything The Guardian is promoting, I'm hostile to. And then there are the people opening their arms to the guy. Vladimir Putin. The Chi-Coms. We haven't heard from Kim Jong-un yet, as far as I know, but I bet there's a luxury apartment in Pyongyang waiting for Snowden, if he wants it. All right, you could say, but that's guilt by association. And what about the Fourth Amendment? And can I really be happy about the feds riffling through my credit card records? Permit me to enlarge upon these issues. Next segment. There is an expression in statecraft that I think we got from Cardinal Richelieu. At any rate, it's always stated in French. Raison d'état, reason of state. The idea is that those charged with running a country have the overriding duty to see that the country goes on existing, even if this means doing things contrary to the country's stated principles or religion. You get a similar flavour from the American maxim that the Constitution is not a suicide pact. Statesmen should never, never be in the business of aiding and abetting national suicide. Naturally, there's plenty of room under the slogan raison d'état for judgment calls and differences of opinion. Back in the Cold War, there were sober, thoughtful people who said that nuclear weapons are immoral. Should we really, they asked, have military personnel in silos up in North Dakota, sitting at keyboards that could wipe out Moscow and Leningrad, incinerating millions of men, women and children? Those people had a point. Still, if we'd held a referendum in 1955 on whether to give up all our nukes, I would have voted to keep them. Raison d'état. Statecraft isn't a weekend game of volleyball. It's in dead earnest. There are things a nation has to do if it wants to keep existing. Some of those things aren't pleasant. Some are downright immoral and unchristian. Some will annoy or inconvenience a lot of people. Some may even injure or kill people. Worse yet, in this age of whiny victimhood, some may, oh my God, hurt people's feelings. We need serious people with sober judgment presiding over the doing of those things. And even then, they'll sometimes get it wrong. Still, the calls have to be made. Raison d'état. I'm not entirely unsympathetic to Edward Snowden's case. Many years ago, I served in a brief and very peripheral way in Her Majesty's Armed Forces. When I took my commission, I had to sign the Official Secrets Act. I wondered at the time what I should do if, in the course of my meagre duties, if I learned that my country was doing something shamefully wrong, under cover of official secrecy. Perhaps something that, in my judgment, was against the national interest. I, in fact, went beyond just wondering. I looked up the regulations to find out. What should I do in that situation? The answer was that I should, quote, seek an opportunity to discuss the matter with my commanding officer. End quote. Since presumably my CO was under the same rule, I guess the idea was that the issue should just be passed up the chain of command until it got lost somewhere in the higher levels of the military bureaucracy. Not really optimal if you have any kind of a conscience, but if you signed the paper, you should stand by your signature. Edward Snowden was not a military person, only an employee of a civilian firm on contract to the DOD. I presume he had to sign something equivalent to the Official Secrets Act, though. If you sign something like that, you've made a commitment, and you should honour that commitment. I'm not very surprised to find that the government is storing my phone and email records. Other things equal, I'd rather they didn't, but I can't say I'm much bothered about it. And yes, I think it does come under a fair definition of raison d'état. As Pat Buchanan said in a very thoughtful and sensible column, this data mining technology is out there, like nuclear weapons knowledge. It won't get uninvented. Other nations will use it against us for their strategic or commercial advantage. We're fools if we don't use it ourselves. So, yes, put me down as anti-Snowden. I don't want the guy boiled in oil, though. If I were the presiding judge in his case, I'd give him 5 years, with time off for good behaviour, just for violating the agreement that he signed. All that said, there is still one point to make. Allow me one more segment on this, please. Okay, so the government is storing all this data on us. On us, the citizens. Raison d'etat? Sure. But can a small government conservative really be happy about this? And if not, is there anything to be done about it? No and yes. No, I'm not happy about it. And yes, there are things I'd like done. The thing that raises my hackles in these conversations is when somebody says, hey, the government has to keep us safe, and they're doing a pretty good job of that. We haven't had another 9/11 after all. No, we haven't. But if you try to get me to say, thank you, Daddy Government, for keeping me safe, the words kind of stick in my throat. Sure, there are things government has to do for reasons of state, including disagreeable things. It seems to me, though, that we could be just as safe, in fact a lot safer, with much less violation of our privacy and our rights. What's all this government effort trying to keep us safe from, after all? Well, the guy who raised my hackles said it. To keep us safe from another 9/11. Sure, a nation of 300 million people is going to throw up the occasional native lunatic, a Timothy McVeigh or a Ted Kaczynski. Most of this data mining effort, though, is trying to keep tabs on crazy Muslims. This guy, for example. Story from the San Francisco Chronicle, June 11th. Long quote. Lawyers for an Uzbek national facing federal terrorism-related charges in Idaho and Utah want a judge to let them withdraw from the case, saying federal budget cuts have left their office with limited resources. Fazlidin Kurbanov, age 30, of Boise, has pleaded not guilty to charges that authorities say involve teaching people to build bombs to target public transportation. In a motion late Monday, court-appointed attorneys Richard Rubin and Thomas Monahan of the Federal Defenders Services of Idaho sought the immediate appointment of a substitute counsel. Rubin told the Associated Press on Tuesday that federal budget cuts, known as sequestration, have reduced the budget of his office by 10% for the current fiscal year. Representing Kurbanov, who was arrested May 17th, in the potentially long and costly case, would sap funding necessary to defend other clients, Rubin said. End quote. Now admit it, you never heard of Fazlidin Kurbanov. You heard of Nidal Hassan, the Fort Hood shooter, and you heard of the Tsarnaev brothers who bombed the Boston Marathon, and you sure as heck heard of the 9/11 terrorists. You never heard of Fazlidin Kurbanov, though, or 100 others like him, because their plans were scuppered by Daddy Government, keeping us safe by snooping on our private activities. Yet, we could be spared the snooping, not to mention Mr. Kurbanov's, quote, long and costly case, and further not to mention the horrors of Fort Hood and the Boston Marathon and 9/11, we could be spared all this if we just kept Muslims out of our country. Sure, that's profiling. And sure, Most Muslims are nice and harmless people. If you let hundreds of thousands of Muslims settle in your country, though, you'll get a few hundred Major Hassans, Muhammad Attas, Tsarnaev brothers, and Fazliddin Kurbanovs. In a perfect world, our visa officers would have mind-reading machines, so we could tell, individual by individual, who the lunatics are. In the world we actually inhabit, no such machines exist, and we must fall back on profiling. More generally, an ounce of security at our borders would save a pound of snooping and data mining inside the country. I favour maximum liberty of citizens within the nation, and I believe an essential precondition for that is maximum rigour of security at our borders. The more security we have at our borders, the less we need inside them. So, I'd wish to see a huge transfer of resources from watching people settled in the country to keeping undesirables out. Daddy government will probably end up with the same amount of work to do, but much more of it will be directed at foreigners, to whom our government owes nothing, and less will be directed at citizens, to whom the government owes a duty to respect our liberties. That segues naturally into the Schumer, MacRubio, Scofflaw amnesty, immigration surge and American worker displacement bill, currently being pondered by the US Senate. The Schumer, MacRubio bill naturally does none of the things I've just been recommending. In fact, it does the opposite to all of them. Take the national security issue, for example, which I've just been arguing should be a key concern when considering someone for settlement in the US. Here I'm going to go to Betsy McCoy, who's made something of a specialty of doing detailed analysis on long pieces of legislation. Betsy was instrumental in scuppering Hillary Care 20 years ago, by exactly that kind of detailed analysis. Later she served as Lieutenant Governor of New York. Just recently she's put out a devastating book on Obamacare. Okay, here's Betsy talking about just one aspect of national security being weakened by the Schumer-MacRubio bill, which she has actually read, the whole thing from beginning to end. Here's Betsy. I apologise for the poor sound quality.
As you know, there have been numerous terrorist attacks committed by people connected with asylum seeking, either asylum seekers themselves or members of their families, including the tragic Boston Marathon bombing just a few weeks ago. That was committed by two young men whose parents sought asylum in the United States. Well, rather than tightening up asylum, this bill actually weakens the controls. Under current law, if somebody comes to the United States sneaking in or on a tourist visa or a business visa, they have 1 year to declare themselves asylum seekers and to make their case. This bill waives the 1 year deadline, so they have until they get caught to seek asylum. Secondly, this bill creates a new layer of appeals. So asylum seekers who are turned down get to stay in the country even longer and appeal the decision, right? And thirdly, this bill gives the Attorney General of the United States discretion to pay all the legal bills for those asylum seekers. Current law prohibits that. So I've written down these sections, 3401, 3404, and 3401, 3504, and 3502. You take a look, they're right in here. We have to erase those sections immediately.
What you see here, in fact, when you read or listen to analyses of the amnesty bill is a complete inversion of the principles that I've been laying out. What you see is a falling over ourselves to accommodate the interests and wishes of foreigners, without any concern at all for the safety or liberty of citizens. What you also see is a kind of lightheadedness, a kind of frivolity. You find yourself asking, are we really a serious nation? Are we really capable of managing raison d'etat in a grown-up way, a way that benefits citizens, however much it may inconvenience non-citizens? We used to be a serious nation in that way. 60 years ago, the Eisenhower administration conducted mass deportations of Mexicans illegally resident here. Nobody bothered to worry how the deportees felt about it. They were here illegally. They should be sent home. Nowadays, we weep and moan and wring our hands about people living in the shadows, as if they hadn't chosen to live there. And we drool and fawn and sob about dreamers who are dreaming of availing themselves of all the accumulated social capital and benefits of a nation they have no right to be in. It's frivolous. A serious nation has a serious concern for its own citizens and a stern discipline for uninvited or misbehaving foreigners. We are not that nation. We are a frivolous nation, playing at being a nation. And the Schumer-McRubio amnesty bill ups the level of frivolity. I confess I never watch MSNBC, but listeners send me clips. It looks really zany. There's a whole TV channel of stuff like this. One clip I just watched is of a black guy identified as Touré, with an acute accent over the E. Touré. That's a cool thing to have nowadays if you're black, or blackish. An E with an acute accent. Pop singer Beyoncé Knowles has one. And there's a law professor, a black lady prominent in critical race theory, named Kimberly Williams Crenshaw. That's not Kimberly EY, it's Kimberly E acute. It seems to be something to do with black identity. Possibly the acute accent was invented by the Zulus, I don't know. Anyway, there's this black guy identified as Touré, no last name. I googled him, and his last name is actually Neblet, so you can see why he doesn't use it. I mean, Neblet. It might as well be Cranshaw, or Fotheringay, or, well, Derbyshire. If he put the Neblet after the Touré, it would totally cancel out the ethnic assertion of that acute accent. So, someone sent me this clip of Touré talking about, can you guess? Yep, his own blackness. He says he's tired of feeling like he and other blacks have to maintain a pattern of behaviour that whites do not. He gave a name to his tiredness. Proper Negro fatigue. Then he fretted that no matter how hard he tried at being non-threatening, he could still end up dead. I guess because, you know, white people are so dangerous to blacks. I asked around, and apparently this is Touré's sole topic of conversation. He's a professional black guy and seems to be making a nice living at it. Then there's this story about a different MSNBC presenter named Chris Hayes. When I saw his picture, I thought, oh, he's their token homosexual. He has a smooth, girly face, an expensive haircut, and artsy spectacle frames. His internet bio says he's married, though, and his spouse's name looks like a female name, so probably I'm wrong here. Hell, half the 30-something guys I see nowadays look like girls. What's going on here? Estrogen in the drinking water? Well, this Chris Hayes is in the news because he identified the late George Wallace as a Republican, and then he had to issue an apology for his slip. Well, people who live in glass houses, I guess. Last week, I identified Istanbul as the capital of Turkey. On the other hand, I'm not paid anything like as much as Mr. Hayes. The George Wallace slip got conservatives chuckling because the thought processes that led to it are so obvious. George Wallace was a racist, therefore he must have been a Republican. Leaving aside the fact that today's Republican Party is so thoroughly race-whipped that any black guy who shows up at a GOP meeting is at once elected chairman by acclamation. Leaving that aside, it underestimates George Wallace, who, as a circuit court judge in Alabama in the 1950s, was famously respectful to blacks. On one occasion, when a prosecutor kept referring to a black plaintiff by his first name, as was commonly done in the South in those days, Judge Wallace reprimanded him, telling him to use the plaintiff's last name, as he would for a white. It's too much to expect these sheltered, pampered young metrosexuals to know any history, though, or to see more than one dimension in anything or person. They're too busy having manicures and facials and picking out $1,200 spectacle frames. There's a lot of things to dislike about modern liberalism, but its sheer wanton ignorance is way out in front, as far as I'm concerned. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. This week has seen jury selection going on for the upcoming trial for second-degree murder of George Zimmerman in Sanford, Florida. You don't need to be a jurisprudential genius to figure out how this trial will go. Sanford is 45% non-Hispanic white, 30% black, 20% Hispanic. So, in the jury that we end up with after jury selection, it'll be 6 jurors plus 4 alternates. In that jury, there will surely be at least a couple of blacks. Those blacks will find Zimmerman guilty, just out of racial solidarity, regardless of the evidence. If the non-blacks agree, that will be a guilty verdict. If they don't, and they most likely won't, the evidence for second-degree murder looks pretty thin, then it'll be a hung jury and a retrial. There's no reason to think a retrial will go any differently, so this show will run and run. On the very slim possibility that the trial, or retrial, or retrial, on the very slim possibility that it comes up with an acquittal, then the US Justice Department will bring a federal case against Zimmerman for violating Trayvon Martin's civil rights, or some such bullpoop. George Zimmerman may as well get new business cards printed up describing himself as professional defendant. That's what he is from now on, a professional defendant. No job, no income, no liberty, no life, just a professional defendant. A sacrificial goat for the appeasement of the black race lobbies and their white liberal enablers. And all the guy was trying to do was keep his neighbourhood safe. Item, the east end of New York's Long Island is very tony. You've probably heard of the Hamptons, which are out there, and where many celebrities and Wall Street tycoons have homes. Well, all those rich people need a lot of servants to look after them, to keep their homes and gardens looking nice. So, the local Hispanic population has been growing by leaps and bounds. The New York Times reports that the Hispanic population of East Hampton went from a mere 5% in 1990 to 15% in 2000 to over 26% in 2010. This is causing lots of problems in the local high school, the Times tells us. Kids disappear for weeks at a time in visits back home to Mexico and points south. Parents can't understand what's going on at school meetings. They've had to start up English as a second language classes and hire 3 Spanish-speaking social workers. Most upsetting of all, there have been 3 student suicides in the last 3 years, all of them Hispanics. That's in a student body of 900. An uncomfortable ethnic integration problem, the Times report calls it. I guess so. East Hampton has a modest-sized middle class in addition to all the rich folk. Even in the Hamptons, you need dentists, schoolteachers, realtors and cops. I guess it's their kids whose school is being disrupted by this Hispanic influence. I'm assuming the tycoons and celebrities all send their kids to private schools. So this is classic class conflict. The top and the bottom against the middle. You can file that one under the heading, "There Goes the Neighbourhood." Item. I keep trying to think of something coherent to say about Syria, and I keep failing. The latest news there is that the USA is now definitely going to ship military supplies to the rebels fighting against Bashar Assad. Since the most energetic of the rebels are Al-Qaeda, or allied thereto, this doesn't make a lot of sense. I asked a friend who knows his way around the intelligence community. He gave me a long string of pros about how it's all a game of chicken with the Russians, who've been supporting Assad because they have a naval base there and a big market for their weapons and military supplies. Okay, but it still doesn't make sense. What's in it for us to play chicken with the Russians? And if Assad looks like he's losing, won't the Russians just switch sides to keep their base and their market with the post-Assad government? They're not exactly well known for sentimentality in their foreign affairs dealings. Bottom line here, it seems to me, this is a real geostrategic chess game. You have to hope our administration knows what it's doing. The record in Egypt and Libya does not inspire confidence, but let's hope. Meanwhile, the State Department is making noises about settling Syrian refugees in the USA. This will be on top of the tens of thousands of Iraqis we're still bringing in. 12,400 just in the last 8 months. Of Iraqi refugees in general, 67% are unemployed and 95% are on food stamps. 2 Iraqi refugees in Kentucky have already been convicted of trying to send arms to Al-Qaeda. Why on earth are we planning to import more such problems for ourselves? Tens of thousands upon tens of thousands of semi-literate third worlders a high proportion of them Muslims, who will be welfare burdens for decades to come. Why would we do this? Oh, did I mention? The UN High Commissioner for Refugees has announced its intention to refer up to 50,000 Congolese for resettlement over the next 5 years. Most of them, we are told, will come to the USA. Good grief. That's it, ladies and gents. I admit I'm a little dispirited this week, weighed down by so much folly and frivolity. Casting around for a nice, light-hearted novelty number to see us out with, I came up with this, which I offer to you in honour of 44-year-old Anna Lilia Trujillo of Houston, Texas. Last Sunday, Miss Trujillo stabbed her 59-year-old lover to death with a stiletto heel. Now that's one hard-hearted lady. And since Anna is close enough to Hannah, there's my opening. More from Radio Derb next week.
They call her hard-hearted Hannah, the vamp of Savannah, the meanest gal in town. Talk of your cold, refrigerating mamas, brother, she's a polar bear's pajama. To tease them and thrill them, torture and kill them, that's her delight, they say. An evening spent with Hannah sitting on your knees is like traveling through Alaska in your BVDs. Hard-hearted Hannah, the vamp of Savannah, yeah. She's so cold you get pneumonia from her breath. She kissed an Eskimo and he was almost froze to death. Hard-hearted Hannah, the